Last Friday, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced that a cow tested under its new rapid screening program came back with, quote, inconclusive results and was sent for follow-up test at Ames, Iowa lab. And another such case was announced on Tuesday, and a sample from that animal was sent to the same lab for additional tests. On Wednesday, the USDA said these additional tests showed that the first animal was not infected with the disease, and results are still pending on a second animal. But my next guest says that if he were a betting man, he'd wager a good drink that this cow, too, would also show up to be disease-free. The announcement of these inconclusive results sent the price of cattle at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange sharply down and undoubtedly had meat-eating consumers rethinking their holiday weekend barbecue plans. Is that an overreaction or simply good reasoned judgment? We're going to start the hour today talking about testing for mad cow disease under the government's new rapid screening program in place since June 1st. That's just about over a month. How's it working? What does it really mean when the screening test comes up inconclusive? What's done after that to determine if an animal has a disease or not? If you'd like to join our discussion, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guest. Dr. Alex Ardanz is the director of the California Animal Health and Food Safety Laboratory System and a professor of medicine and of epidemiology at the School of Veterinary Medicine, University of California, Davis. He joins us by phone from his office. Welcome to the program, Dr. Ardanz.
Thank you.
You are part of a system of test laboratories in California that you test the cows in California. Is that correct?
Yes, and we're part of the national program. We also have the responsibility for testing samples that come in from Arizona and Nevada as well.
There's a rumor that it was your lab that tested one of these cows. Can you confirm or deny that?
All the questions like that, Ira, have to be directed toward the USDA.
Very good. Very skilled at that. Thank you. Let me talk about the test. Yeah, I mentioned that if I quoted you saying that if you were a betting man, that you would bet that the second test would come back negative also. Did I accurately reflect what you think?
You know, I hate to see it quoted like that, but that's the way I talk. Ira, that was based on information that we received at a workshop just this last week, and in from previous discussions with some of our colleagues in Europe. And one of our colleagues from Europe just this last week is an individual that's in charge of a very high throughput lab in Great Britain, and he pointed out in his presentation that this last week that virtually every one of their inconclusives would come back as negative. And so that's what I based my statement on.
Why should that be that way?
Because this test, as most screening tests are designed, are set very, very sensitive. And so they're set that way so that there is we eliminate the chance that we're going to miss any animal. We would rather, when these tests are designed, and we have participated in testing schemes like this with other conditions as well, but we would rather have it overly sensitive, and then we can go into a second generation type test, so to speak. They are the confirmatory tests, and then we can definitively exclude or rule in a test based on that. But these tests should be taken for what the term says. They are screening tests, and these type things go on in laboratories all the time. We get these type of reactions, and then they are subjected to further testing to really find out what the definitive answer is.
And how many tests do you think the USDA is going to do this year or per year?
Well, they have targeted close to 300,000 for this year, and that's based on statistical models that have been developed for them.
Do you think that's adequate?
The model has been developed so that it will test, or it has a 99% chance of identifying 1 in 10 million cattle. So if we had one animal per 10 million cattle, we are confident at the 99% level that we will be able to detect a level of infection at that level, the 1 in 10 million.
Mm-hmm. You're quoted in the Sacramento Bee as saying that in Ireland they test between 5 to 8,000 per month, and we could do that easily in this country. My math on 5,000 a month is about 1.8 million cows per year.
I mean, my comment there is we have the technology, the resources, mm-hmm. to do that should that ever be deemed necessary.
Mm-hmm. And the USDA says that these tests are not supposed to be for public health and safety. This is not being done for the public safety, but I guess just to screen the cows.
Yes, and that's the point of this program, is that these tests, as USDA has appropriately said, are not a food safety type of a test. What we're trying to do in this country, as the best of my understanding, is to understand what the prevalence, if any, is in our cattle population in the United States, so that we know as a country, and also we can convey this information to our trading partners.
Mm-hmm. So who should be in charge of then making sure that the public is healthy? If you're just testing to see what the prevalence in the cows are, where does the public fit in here?
Well, I think the precautions, the changes that USDA has implemented to make sure that high-risk animals, those animals with neurologic or nervous system disease, do not enter the food change, or the food chain per se. Plus, what they're doing is making sure that the specified risk materials, and those would be tissues from the central nervous system, the brain, the spinal cord, the dorsal root ganglia, those type of tissues, plus intestinal tissues, do not enter the food chain, then I think they've done probably as good a job as is possible. And that's very much what the programs are based on in Europe also.
But the critics will claim that we're not testing as many cows as they do overseas.
But I think that, Ira, we're dealing with different types of management systems, husbandry, than what they're dealing with in Europe. For example, in our country, at least 85% of all the beef that is processed, that you and I eat on an everyday basis, is less than 18 months of age. And I know for a fact that in California, a considerable portion of our beef is even less than 18 months of age. Now, the reason that I think it is futile to test that young of animal is that when you look at all the experimental work where they've experimentally induced BSE in cattle, they were unable to detect presence of the prion in the central nervous system, and that's the tissue we're testing. They were unable to detect it in there much before 30 months of age. Mm-hmm. So if we were, in fact, testing all these animals that are 18 months and less, our chances are very remote that we would even pick up anything there. And again, I think we have to learn from what is being done in Europe. And they have targeted that high-risk population, and then they are testing their animals over 30 months of age. But when you look at our beef, again, the majority of it, the preponderance of it, comes from animals that are very young. so to speak.
Yeah, but if you have a problem of exporting the beef because people are afraid to eat American beef because it's not tested as whether it should be or shouldn't be. Let's put that aside. And if you have the ability to test more of the animals and you can come up with more of the tests, wouldn't that be prudent to do that so that you might be able to sell the beef more easily to Japan and then these other countries?
Well, those are decisions that are best left to the policymakers. And again, my point is that the chances of us finding anything in that young population, and I think that even today I just saw an email that came out that the Japanese are now recognizing that are understanding the age of animal that is processed in this country, and from my cursory look at this note, it seems like they are backing off of their demands for 100% testing.
Mm. So because we eat younger animals, the chances are less? Would that be a way to summarize it?
I would think so. And then, I think we'd also have to emphasize is that experimentally, they have never been able to induce the disease when they've used skeletal muscle. And that's the meat that we eat. That's our beefsteak, our hamburgers, and they have never been able to induce the disease experimentally using those tissues. And so that gives me comfort as a consumer on this end that I feel very confident that our beef is safe.
Mm-hmm. But there are people who talk about, the method of killing the animal might scatter the brain tissue around.
And I think that, and again, those are areas that I am not conversant in, Ira, but it's my understanding that those methods have been eliminated or are being eliminated, but to the best of my understanding, they have been eliminated in our processing plants.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you for taking time to talk with us, and you're reassuring us that you think the meat supply is safe from at least this form, this threat.
I feel that it is in our country, yes.
Mm-hmm. And you think we're doing enough testing, and the number of animals are being tested are quite sufficient.
I think if we, and I have every confidence that we'll get up to the numbers that have been projected. It's early in the testing program, and we're all learning about the program. But I'm confident that we'll, as we get up to full speed, we'll get those numbers, and then we can say with reasonable assurity that, again, going back to that 99% confidence level, when we get those number of animals tested.
All right. Well, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us.
Well, thank you.
And good luck to you. Have a happy holiday weekend.
We appreciate that, and same to you, Ira.
Thank you. Dr. Alex Ardanz is director of the California Animal Health and Food Safety Laboratory System and a professor of medicine and of epidemiology at the School of Veterinary Medicine at the University of California in Davis. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we can continue with our series of picking the brains of some very smart people. We had Dr. DeBakey, Michael DeBakey, on a while back. We're going to continue talking with Dr. Eric Kandel now. He studies aplasia. We'll talk about what those small animals have helped us understand about how our brains and memory work. And the Nobel Prize winner, Dr. Kandel, will be with us. He'll be here to answer your questions, so don't go away. We'll be right back after this short break.